This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Despite his name, John Katz is a dog person, and he's concerned about the roles pets play in our lives. Do we ask too much of our pets? Do we rely on them for the company and emotional support we're not getting from friends and family? Do we ask things of them that go against their nature? Katz discusses these questions in his latest book, The New Work of Dogs, now out in paperback. His previous book, A Dog Year, was about the death of his two Labrador retrievers and how he raised and trained two border collies. Katz also is a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers. But yes, he does have a life apart from his dogs. He's the author of 12 books, including a series of suburban detective novels. He's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Wired, and he's a contributing editor to the public radio program Marketplace. Terry spoke to Katz last year. He was at a studio in New Jersey with his two border collies sleeping at his feet. Terry asked him about the new ways dogs figure into the lives of humans.
In the last 25 or 30 years, I really date this to the rise of television and the decline in the extended family and the rise in divorce rates and more people living alone and work becoming unstable for many people. People have begun to use dogs in a more intensely personal way as either human surrogates, substitutes for people in cases where they're lonely or disconnected or fragmented, or as members of the family. Dogs are getting human names, they're sleeping in bed. I kind of joke sometimes that, you know, the boomers created the gifted and talented child, and now they're working on the gifted and talented dog. where, you know, one woman came to me at a reading and said, well, you know, Mondays we do agility and Tuesdays we do obedience and Wednesday we go herding, and what can I do on Thursdays and Fridays? I said, well, maybe the guy should just, you know, sit in the yard and, you know, sniff some other dog's butt or something, you know, let him relax. On the other hand, I found the subject to be a little darker and more complicated than I thought when I entered it. I think the culture kind of glorifies the human-dog bond for good reason. It's quite wonderful. But sometimes it's a bit unthinking and uncritical to the extent that there aren't a lot of people really wondering whether this view of dogs as human-like is really good for them, or whether, I guess I ended up wondering myself whether it's really good for people.
So you're seeing this like new relationship between people and their dogs as being troubling because of what it says about people's people-to-people relationships. Are you watching dogs become more neurotic as people are relying on them more for love and companionship and telepathy and mysticism and all these other things?
Yes, I think there's enormous evidence, and I think any trainer would agree with me. For one thing, last year in the United States, 400,000 children were bitten severely enough to require hospitalization, which is a staggering rise. You see dogs are increasingly under pressure, neurotic, chewing up the house, jumping on people. You have the new element of the rescue dog, the abused dog, which dog that certainly exists. But this all becomes an element in our ability to do what I think is our primary responsibility with animals, which is to show them how to live in the world, which means training them, which means thinking about how we get them, thinking about the kind of dog or cat that we get, whether it's right for us, and then doing the work to help it acclimate to an increasingly hostile world. So I do see behavior that's very, very increasingly neurotic, and as the dogs are being pressured to do things dogs really can't do.
Like what? What are some of the things dogs are being pressured to do?
Well, people perceive dogs as loving them unconditionally and uncritically, and to some extent that's certainly true, but dogs really can't understand when we're depressed or when we had a bad day at work, or they really can't give us the kind of emotional support that human beings can give us.
They can't say to you, your boss was wrong, you're right.
Well, I had a great, you know, my first shocking introduction to this actually was when I took my border collie, Orson, who had a lot of problems, out to a trainer in Pennsylvania named Carolyn Wilkie, and I said, you know, Carolyn, I said, I'm having terrible trouble with this dog. You know, the problem is he's so attached to me. I think if anything happened to me, why, you just have to shoot him because he couldn't live with anybody else. And I remember her getting right in my face and saying, listen, pal, if anything happened to you, I would buy a can of beef liver, and in 2 days, this dog would forget that you ever walked the earth, and don't you forget it. And this was a bit of a shock to me, but it was something I really needed to hear because I could see the truth of it. It doesn't mean that that he doesn't love me or that I don't love him, but it means it's a reminder. It was a reminder to me that I was beginning to project onto him things that were mine, an attitude about authority. I saw him as being rebellious and devious and willful, and these were things that were much more true of me than of him. The problem was I just didn't know how to train him.
Breeds often have special, you know, different breeds of dogs often have special skills, a special type of intelligence, and special needs. You have border collies that you've gotten from breeders.
Right.
What are the unique qualities of border collies?
Well, these dogs have to have work to do or they go nuts. You know, they're very intense. They're very energetic. So we do all kinds of work. We clear geese out of neighborhood parks and schoolyards. We go do sheep herding 3 or 4 times a week. We go for lots of walks a day. You know, but they have. This is a good example of a breed. They're great dogs, but if you don't have work for them to do, they're not good dogs to have. And you see them all over the place in cities now, ever since the movie Babe came out. And it's a good example. I mean, it's the same with dogs like Labs and Retrievers. They're wonderful dogs, but they need to have work. They need to have exercise. A lot of breeds have very distinct characteristics. Springer Spaniels, for example, have a reason why they're called Springers. And there's a number of breeds, you know, Bichons and Westies and other dogs that really like to be in apartments and don't need a lot of exercise and don't mind being left alone. You know, there are very good breeds for people in almost every circumstance if you do the work. They're dogs that are fine in apartments, dogs that don't mind being left alone for hours if they get some exercise. But the marketing of dogs in America, the emotionalization of them sort of is leading people to, you know, it's like the bigger and more energetic the dog in the suburbs, the more likely people are to get it. So you see Labs and Retrievers all over the place, these big 100-pound dogs with no chance to run anywhere. No exercise, and who are not trained.
Well, you know, you said that you got your border collies and that they need to work, and you take them to sheep herd a few times a week. Do you have a lot of farms within your area that have sheep?
There actually are more than you might think. I actually go to Pennsylvania, which is only an hour from me, and we actually take care of a couple of hundred sheep. We graze them several times, 3 or 4 times a week, and I have come to love that quite a bit. I'm probably the least likely person on the planet to be doing that. But I've really come to love doing that with the dogs. You don't have to go, there's other kinds of work you can do from agility work to just going to parks and throwing balls and frisbees around. But it's been quite extraordinary for me to be involved with the dogs and with sheep because you sort of see why there are dogs when you do something like that. And the dog people are quite wonderful. You know, the dog lovers will do almost anything for their dogs. Once they figure out what it is they ought to be doing.
Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with John Katz.
How did you get your border collies?
A breeder in Texas read Running to the Mountain, which was not about dogs, but had two dogs in it, two labs, my previous dogs.
This is about a 6-month break you took from your real life to live alone on a mountain with your dogs.
Right. That's basically right. It was somewhat a book about Thomas Merton and some of his writings about solitude, experience with solitude, I guess, and was part of the book. And I went with two labs, without whom I don't think I could have survived the experience. They kept me company, and they were quite great. One of the dogs, whenever he wanted to play, he would come up and nip me on the butt and get me moving. And I recounted this in the book. And this breeder, Deanna, in Texas, read it, and she said, now that's a person that could have a border collie. And she had this very troubled dog. At the time, his name was Devin, who was a sort of failed obedience dog and had been confined for several months in a crate, and it was just a mess. And she shipped him to Newark and said, you know, I have this feeling from reading your work that you will keep faith with this dog, that you'll do whatever it takes to work things out with this dog. And he was a nightmare. He was practically destroyed my neighborhood, my house, dented my marriage pretty good. Was jumping through windows, hurting school buses. He was just out of his mind. And that's what began this whole journey of sort of understanding. I loved him right away, of course, and identified with him. And in order to keep him, I knew I was going to have to learn a lot more about dogs than I knew. And that's what started the whole turn towards dog riding. And the fact that he can lie here like this is a miracle, really.
So you had this ornery dog that wasn't behaving, and you had to train him in order to be able to live with the dog and have the dog live in your community, and in order to remain married.
That's right. So, in order to not have windows and all that sort of thing.
I mean, there's a difference, I think, between training a puppy where all the puppy's behaviors are just kind of like puppy behaviors, but they haven't really learned a lot yet. You don't have to unteach them a lot of things. Compared to an adult dog that's had something of a life, and you have to totally refashion their behavior, where did you start?
This was one of the most difficult things I'd ever done in my life. It's still ongoing. I think it will never be quite finished, but I don't think I've ever taken on a harder thing for me because it spoke directly to my own problems as a human. Impatience and anger and frustration and short attention span and distraction and all the things that get in the way of doing what he needed. And I loved him, of course, right away and was confronted with this very simple drama. Either I learned about dogs, and I was surprised, by the way, how little I knew about dogs. I thought I knew more than I did. When I started hanging around with trainers, I did take a training course and became a trainer to research the new work of dogs. I don't train dogs, but I learned enough about it so that I could know a little bit of what I was writing about. I was stunned that I was almost everything I thought about dogs was wrong. Everything I thought was going on in his head was wrong. The way I was communicating with him was wrong. My tone of voice was wrong. The repetition of commands was wrong. My whole understanding of what he was about was wrong. And when I realized how essentially simple, how food-driven, how attention-driven he was, it became, I wouldn't say easy, very, very manageable to do. But in order to do that, I had to acknowledge, repeatedly that almost every assumption I had about dogs was not right.
What's one or two of the things that you were doing wrong?
Well, the first thing, of course, is the most common. I was anthropomorphizing him. I was attributing all sorts of human-like emotions to him. I was, he was being devious. He was being rebellious. He was being willful. He was being stubborn. He was jealous. It was all these things that humans are that are not really dog traits. What he really was confused. He couldn't tell friend from foe. He didn't understand what people were asking. I mean, he didn't make sense of the world. This is, by the way, why I started with the sheep. I mean, I'm not a person who's naturally inclined to spend time with sheep. But it's just not in my repertoire. But everything I read about border collies, including this trainer in Ireland who I was emailing with, said, look, this dog will not make sense of the world until he does what he's supposed to do and gets around some livestock for a while. And that was true. I mean, he's not much of a sheepdog. He's much too skitsy and intense for that. But the world is beginning to make sense to him, and that was very good advice. But I think this whole idea, the less I saw him as a human version of me and the more I saw him as a dog, the easier it was to train him, the better behaved he became, and the happier he and I are, and the more likely I was to remain married.
Did you do the whole reward and punishment approach?
I came into the hands of a positive reinforcement trainer who does not do punishment. She does, and this is Carolyn, she's very tough about that. You basically give the dog the chance to succeed and praise it with a combination of food and verbal and physical reward. And you don't yell at it or scold it or correct it or throw things at it or put electronic devices on it. You just praise them when they're doing the right thing.
Why no punishment?
Well, the positive reinforcement, which is a growing training in the dog world, really holds that yelling and throwing things and criticism makes them more stressed and that they end up having displaced aggression and displaced neurotic behavior, that they don't, any more than kids, they don't like being yelled at. And they don't like having things thrown at them. And they don't like having people scream in their faces. And that you know, like a kid, you can get a dog to do anything by scaring it. But as also with a kid, that's not the best way to do it. I'm embarrassed to tell you that a new dog arrived in my household last week, a puppy from Colorado named Rose. And I'm training her in this positive way from the beginning. And it's amazing to me, in 24 hours, this dog comes and sits happily and lies down and is housebroken. I'm a great believer in that. Now, I'm not 100% positive person, so I sometimes will lose it, as we all will, which is fine. But I think it's a great training method. I think it really works. I think the dog responds very quickly. And best of all, you have this great grounded relationship with a dog. It's born out of real positive affection and not out of terror or intimidation, which I think is great.
Okay, housebreaking a dog. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't have a dog, sadly. But the people who I saw training their dogs, what they would do is if the dog, like, pooped in the house, they would bring the dog over to the poop, basically stick the dog's nose in it, spank them a little bit, and then put them either on the newspaper or outside, wherever it was that they wanted to direct the dog to be pooping in the future. That's negative reinforcement, right?
Yeah, that's a great. I did that with my labs. I mean, I did that with many dogs. The way I housebroke Rose or Homer in a day or two was I got a crate. I put the puppy in the crate, fed the dog in the crate, waited 30 minutes, carried the dog outside. The dog immediately went to the bathroom. I danced around in the moonlight, yelling and whooping and throwing food around. And three times, and the dog was housebroken. I didn't drag her. I didn't stick her nose in it. I didn't scream at her. I didn't do any bad dog. And it worked in 24 hours. I've done that with two dogs now.
You feed them in a box, and then 30 minutes later...
You just feed them in the crate. You get a kennel crate, and they like it. It makes them feel safe.
Uh-huh.
You give them their food in the crate. You just put the bowl in the crate. You close the crate. You go... You know, read the paper or watch television. In a half an hour or so, you come back. You open the crate. You pick the dog out. Take the dog outside. The dog will almost immediately go to the bathroom because puppies go quickly after they eat. And then you just praise the dog. You make a lot of noise. You give it a treat. You tell how good they are. You get excited and dance around and look like a jerk. I've housebroken dogs in about a day. You'll have occasional accidents or something, but they're happy. You know, this is an interesting thing to talk about, Terry, because it goes to the heart of why I wrote the book. It's a good example of why the more you understand what dogs are like and treat them as dogs, the easier it is to do these things. Housebreaking is really very simple. Dogs prefer to go outside, and they don't like to be yelled at. It just makes them more nervous and more likely to pee all over the place. So this is such a simple thing. I mean, the way I learned to teach my dogs to come to me before, I used to yell and scream and throw chains and jump around and make a lot of noise to no effect. Now I just get, I put a bunch of meatballs in my hand and I walk backwards. There's not a dog on the planet that won't come running towards you. And when they come to me, I give her the meatball and say, good girl, good come. And she knows how to come. And I didn't, you know, there's no yelling or throwing or stomping or shock collars or any of this dreadful stuff. I sometimes think when I spent this year with people and their dogs that what I saw was a country, as much as we love our dogs, we're almost having a civil war with them. Because we all know people like this who, I'm sorry my dog jumped on you, but he was abused, so I can't train him. Or she's always been aggressive with people, or she's always hated female dogs, or she's always chewed up the house. People live with these awful behaviors and are constantly yelling and tugging at their dogs and scolding them and clucking about them. And it's too bad because it doesn't need to be like that, really. And it was frustrating, really, to see.
Well, John Katz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Terry.
John Katz, speaking with Terry Gross last fall. His latest book, The New Work of Dogs, is now out in paperback.